In the earlier lessons, we came across the first speech of Eliphaz, which took up two chapters, chapters 4 and 5. We saw that his intention was laudable. He and his friends were truly filled with compassion for Job, and they had set out on a long and perilous journey just to be with Job. But unfortunately, what is happening behind the scenes are the manipulations of Satan working in the mind. Satan, as we saw, has a special preference for mind games, and he will not stop at manipulating people's minds, even the minds of believers, if he's given any opportunity. And as a result of the manipulations of Satan, we find that Eliphaz and his friend started out with good intentions, driven by compassion, but they end up being harshly critical of Job, completely unfair to him, and that provokes a whole series of rebuttals by Job, which, though it may appear tedious, serves to thresh out the issues involved in why human beings suffer at all, and why believers suffer for no apparent reason. So, having gone through the Council of Eliphaz, how do we summarize it? We can summarize it in 5 points, and these are listed briefly on the whiteboard. His first point is that all human beings are sinners and fall short of the standards that are set by a righteous and holy God. You cannot argue with that because the Bible tells us so. And as a result of the fact that all human beings fall short of God's standards, it is not surprising, therefore, that suffering is a common lot of mankind. So what Job is saying is, don't make a big issue about it, because suffering is a common lot of human beings. What appears to have provoked Eliphaz to this line of argument is Job's outburst in chapter 3. We saw that in chapter 3, Job let off a long tirade which came dangerously close to accusing God as being the cause of all the suffering and the unfairness that he was experiencing. He didn't quite get to the point of accusing God, but as far as Eliphaz and his friends perceived it, Job came dangerously close to blaming God. And had Job done that literally, Satan would have won the argument with God. So there is a very high stakes involved in the way Job responds to his trials. And it is so with us. Seldom, very seldom, does the Holy Spirit tell us in advance that we are being tested and what the issues are in the testing. So we need to be careful. The way we respond to our particular testing may decide major issues in our life. We need always to be aware of the fact that nothing happens to us by chance. There is always a spiritual dimension to life on earth, particularly so for the believer. And the believer has to be aware of it, so that even your daily words and deeds and motives do carry a spiritual significance. The way you respond to irritation or provocation, it may seem to you to be just a daily affair, but there could be a bigger issue underlying it. We just need to be aware, and being aware, we need to exercise restraint. The third point that Eliphaz makes and emphasizes and tries to reinforce is that God is inherently just. That being the case, there is always a strictly causal relationship between sin and suffering. You have to realize that though people of those days were deprived of the fuller revelation of God, so to them, and to Eliphaz and his friends in particular, who are not aware of the full scope of life hereafter, to them and to their fellow human beings of that day, the only way they could identify or be sure of God's blessing was if they had it in material terms. Likewise, the removal of material blessings signified to them the removal of God's favor. We who have the fuller revelation of Scripture know that it is not necessarily the case. Yes, unconfessed sin does provoke God to act, but it does not mean that the suffering of believers is always caused by sin. And Job is a classic example of this. The fourth point that Eliphaz made is this. It's linked to the third point. If it is true that there is a strictly causal relationship between suffering and sin, the way out for Job was to stop protesting his innocence and just throw himself upon the mercy of God. But as far as Job was concerned, it is not as simple as that, because he knew, or his own convictions were, that he was innocent. Therefore, how could he confess to a crime, to a sin which he had never committed? To do so would be to lie against God. So it's a very difficult position, a real dilemma that Job is in. He wants to be released from his suffering. His friends are telling him, just throw yourself on the mercy of God. But Job feels within himself that it would be ridiculous to do that. It would make a mockery of God's justice to appeal for pardon where there is no sin. To continue to appeal to God for pardon when you have not sinned is essentially to make a mockery of God's justice. So Job was caught in this dilemma. And it didn't help, and this is the fifth point, it didn't help that Eliphaz kept insisting that God is all-wise and all-powerful. He's also compassionate. Only God can set things right for Job, which is true. Job needs only to confess his secret sin, which is not true in Job's case. On the face of it, the counsel of Eliphaz is thoroughly reasonable, but there is a fatal flaw in his line of argument. And it would help us to try and identify the flaw in the counsel of Eliphaz. I wonder if you can spot it. It is not very obvious. It is the kind of argument that any reasonable person would offer. But if you think about it carefully, the argument of Job has a fatal flaw. And that flaw is this. His counsel is predicated on the notion that obedience to God always brings with it material blessings. That is not necessarily the case. It seems to be beyond the comprehension of Eliphaz and his friends that as far as this earthly life is concerned, true believers without any secret sin in them do sometimes suffer for no apparent reason. And we today who have the fuller revelation of Scripture know the reason why. The reason why is given to us in 1 Peter chapter 1 verse 7, where Peter admonishes the believers that if they find themselves suffering for no apparent reason, to take heart in this consideration, that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perishes, though it, that is your faith, be tried with fire, might be found unto praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. What this means is that believers who suffer for no apparent reason are going through a rigorous training program which is intended to strengthen their faith. So it is unfortunate that Eliphaz and his friends lack the fuller revelation of Scripture, and to their limited understanding, they took Job's suffering as a sign of secret sin. If only life were as simple as that, but life isn't. The other point to note, and this is true of the pagan religions of ancient times. In the pagan religions of ancient times, it is a characteristic that obedience to their god or gods is always driven by the expectation of material reward. We know that that is not the case with Jehovah. We obey God for who He is, not for what we can get out of Him. But the thinking of Eliphaz and his friends is conditioned by the cultural climate in which they live. And in that cultural climate, the pagan religions in the community of which they live always has this idea that you obey because it pays to obey. You worship and obey the pagan gods and do whatever the pagan gods expect of you because it is profitable to do so. That is not the case with Christianity, where obedience is grounded in the character of God, in the love of God. Chapters 6 and 7 constitute Job's reply to Eliphaz's first speech. And why is it in two parts? Chapter 6 is directed to Eliphaz. In chapter 7, Job moves away from addressing Eliphaz because he realizes that Eliphaz is going off the mark. And in chapter 7, that part of his rebuttal is addressed directly to God. Job's rebuttal in chapter 6 and 7 is couched in the most beautiful poetic terms. Why poetry? Why could it not have been in prose? Because Eliphaz's argument was in prose. Why couldn't Job reply? We must be aware of this fact, that prose has its limitations. Where you're trying to capture, where you're trying to portray very intense emotions or passions, where you're trying to express very subtle shades of feeling or emotion, poetry is inadequate as a medium of expression. Prose is inadequate as a medium of expression. You have to fall back on poetry. And the best way to illustrate this is to give you two descriptions of an eagle. The one in plain prose and the other in poetic terms. Description is that of an eagle. First in prose. The eagle is a rapacious bird of the falcon family, remarkable for its strength, size, graceful figure and extraordinary flight capability. Eagle is a rapacious bird of the falcon family, remarkable for its strength, size, graceful figure, and extraordinary flight capability. Can you quarrel with that description of an eagle? You can't. It's perfectly accurate. It captures the essence of the ego. But if you are honest with yourself, can you say that reading that description excites you? Does it enable you in your mind's eye to picture the ego in all its majesty? I dare say that you would not be able to do so. And in that we see the limitations of prose. Now let me give you a poet's eye description of the same ego. And this is taken from Tennyson's poem entitled The Eagle. Here's a description of that same eagle which you heard earlier in prose. He clasps the crag with crooked hands, close to the sun in lonely lands, ringed with the azure world he stands. The wrinkled sea beneath him crawls, he watches from his mountain walls, and like a thunderbolt he falls. See the immediate difference between the two mediums. When you read that poetic description of an eagle, you are transported into the world of the eagle. That mode of expression, the description of the eagle in poetic terms, enables you to be there, to picture the eagle in all its magnificence. You see him standing on the edge of the rock, twisting its neck back and forth, using one of its key assets, its eyes, to scan the scene below it. Above him is a cloudless blue sky. Below the eagle, far below, are the waves crashing on the rocks. And then in the blink of an eye, the eagle soars upwards, gaining altitude, and at the top of its climb, it folds its wings and plummets down to earth like a rocket aimed at its prey. All this is conveyed via poetry. In prose, all you get are the facts. It doesn't move you, it doesn't excite you, it doesn't take you into the world of the eagle. And that is why the writer of the book of Job, which I assume to be Job himself, chooses the medium of poetry to express the most delicate and the most powerful and the most subtle emotions. The prose is limited to the prologue and the epilogue. But the rest of the book, as we saw, is basically poetry, and there's a reason for that. Anyone who has read that poetic description of the eagle and remains unmoved by that description, I dare say, has to be either an actuary or a forex trader. Only people in that category could read poetry and remain unmoved by it. Every language has its peculiar characteristics. Nowhere more so than in the field of poetry. And we find that Hebrew poetry is particularly adept at representing human emotions in terms of words that evoke in the reader sensations. Hebrew poetry is particularly adept at that. Let me give you two examples. Psalm 84, verse 2. My soul longeth, yea, even fainteth for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh crieth out for the living God. Notice the words that evoke the sensations in us as we read them. Longeth, fainteth, crieth out. Second example is taken from Psalm 69, the first three verses. Save me, O God, for the waters are come in unto my soul. I sink in deep mire where there is no standing. I am come into deep waters where the floods overflow me. I am weary of my crying. My throat is dried. Mine eyes fail while I wait for my God. All these terms that I emphasize in the original Hebrew, if you read it, it would evoke the sensations, and via these sensations, the poet seeks to represent particular types of human emotion. So we need to be aware of these characteristics of Hebrew poetry as you read chapter 6 and 7. Remember, chapter 6 is directed at Eliphaz and chapter 7 at God himself. So like it or not, we plunge into a verse-by-verse study of chapter 6. The first three verses. But Job answered and said, "Oh, that my grief were truly weighed, and my calamity laid in the balances together, for now it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. Therefore my words are swallowed up." You notice one thing about Job. In the long discourse of Eliphaz, and this is true of anybody, if you are listening to a person who is accusing you of things of which you are innocent, the natural tendency is for you to keep interrupting the person. You want to get your say, you want to break in, because what that person is saying about you is manifestly untrue. So it requires tremendous restraint to hold your peace and let the other person finish. But Job is exercising that degree of restraint. Throughout Eliphaz's long discourse, which we know and Job knows himself, is, though it is driven by good intention, is way off the mark. There is no record that he interrupted Eliphaz. To his credit, he heard out Eliphaz in all of his criticism first, and then he gives his rebuttal. That is to the credit of Job. He uses, first of all, the metaphor of weighing, assuming that there is an unbalanced, unbiased balance available. Weighing balance, the lever with two pans on it, and it is a just balance. It's not biased in one direction or another. So the question is, what is to be weighed and against what? When you weigh something, you need to have a test weight, because the idea is to get the lever to balance horizontally, and then you know from the weight of the test weight what is the weight of the unknown object. So what is Job saying when he uses this metaphor of weighing? What has to be weighed and against what test weight? Note first of all two Hebrew words, ka'as and hava. Ka'as refers to the vexation of spirit, which is so extreme that if it were sustained, it would completely crush a person. And to get a feel of what this vexation of spirit can do, you should read Psalm 6 verses 2 to 7. That will give you an idea of this kind of deep anguish of the soul. We know that there is a line in Proverbs which goes like somewhat like this, paraphrasing, that if grief and heartache are sustained for too long, it breaks the heart. And this is the idea here in Ka'as. The second word to note is Hava, which in this context means misfortune. What is being said is this: all the material losses that Job has suffered, if you take them collectively, they constitute a crushing blow upon Job. So what is Job saying should be weighed? He is saying that the vexation of spirit that he is undergoing and the misfortune, the material losses that he has sustained should be put together in one pan. They constitute the unknown weight. And the test weight which goes into the other pan is a bag of sand. Not just of any amount of sand, but all the sand of the sea. We need to be aware that in typical Hebrew usage, the word sand represents an immeasurable and unquantifiable amount. But in this particular context, sand is used to indicate a weight that is too heavy to be measured. So what Job is saying is, if I were to put the vexation of spirit and misfortune together on one weighing pan, and all the sand of the sea, a massive test weight on the other pan, the balance would tilt in favor of my misfortune and vexation of spirit. It's a very poetic way of saying my unjustified troubles and psychological trauma is too great to be measured. It's beyond, almost beyond the capacity of the human being to bear it. And as a result, Job says, his words are swallowed up. Given this extreme suffering and all these trials which are unjustified, Job says that he is unable to speak. And this really refers to situations in which we are so emotionally upset that for a time we are left speechless. This is not unusual, and Job is referring to that situation when he says, my words are swallowed up. He says, I'm speechless. I know this is all wrong. I shouldn't be suffering. I don't know what to say. What can I say? A similar thought is given in Psalm 77 verse 4, where the psalmist says, thou holdest mine eyes waking, and listen to this, I am so troubled that I cannot speak. Same thought, profound emotion leaves the psalmist speechless for a time. Now verse 4, chapter 6 verse 4. The arrows of the Almighty are within me, the poison whereof drinketh up my spirit. The terrors of God do set themselves in array against me. There are several beautiful metaphors in this verse which we have to pick out and identify to appreciate the beauty of just this one verse alone. Verse 4. The first metaphor is that of God as a marksman, all of whose arrows have found their target, which is Job. But these are not ordinary arrows, says Job. These are arrows with poison tips. And as each arrow pierces his body, he's saying, the poison in the tip of the arrow enters the bloodstream. And it sets his body almost as it were on fire. He becomes intensely hot and distressed, which is very typical of poisons derived from plants and animals. And the use of poison for tipping the tips of arrows was well known in the ancient world. And these poisons were derived either from plant material or from animals. The example of an animal from which this poison can easily be derived is the poison dart frog. So the use of poison arrows was not something unusual, and it is a beautiful metaphor to represent the kind of anguish, the burning feeling he is experiencing. He compares it to poison in his body. And this poison has come from arrows shot at him by none other than God. The next metaphor that Job uses in this verse is to be found in the second half of the verse. The terrors of God do set themselves in array against me. The metaphor that Job is using here is that of a siege. Before a siege is mounted, a commander would marshal his troops and arrange the disposition of his troops to achieve the maximum effect so that the siege cannot be broken by those who are trapped within. So what Job is saying is God, being the master commander, has arrayed around him a whole gallery of terrors, so well placed that whichever way he turns, there is no relief, there is no escape. And these terrors are the more painful because they are not literal, but they are psychological terrors. You can run away from material or literal or physical terrors, but how do you run away from a psychological terror? It's within you. Wherever you run, you carry it with you. What Job is saying is a very powerful statement. The kind of terrors that God has sent upon me are psychological in nature. Therefore, wherever I run literally, I'm never going to find refuge and peace. God has to intervene to take away these terrors. I cannot deal with it myself because they are internal. As a result of this turn of events, Job has got to the point of feeling, understandably so, that he has lost what was once very precious to him, not his material wealth, but his personal relationship with God as a favored child of God. What Job is saying is, for some reason, God has disowned me as his child, and now he is using me as target practice. God has, in other words, despised me. I'm only fit to be the target for archery practice for God. It's understandable that he should feel this way, but it is of course not justifiable. Verse 5, another set of metaphors. Does the wild ass bray when he hath grass, or loweth the ox over his fodder? You note first that there is a typical parallelism in this verse. Does the wild ass bray when he has grass, loweth the ox over his fodder? Question is, what kind of parallelism is it? We saw in an earlier lesson in Hebrew poetry, there are three types of parallelism. If you can recall, synonymous, synthetic, and antithetical. So which type is verse 5? Is it synonymous, is it synthetic, or antithetic? You notice that the second half of the verse basically repeats the first half in a different way and thereby serves to reinforce the idea of the first half of it. That being the case, since there's nothing new, it's a repeat of the original idea in a different way to reinforce it. It has to be synonymous parallelism. What Job is saying is, whether you're talking about a wild or a domesticated animal, if it has adequate food and water, it would be content. You would not see it manifesting signs of distress like crying out aloud, braying or lowing. I have a pond of koi fish, and I notice that they are very, somehow they know when it is feeding time. If we miss that time or we delay feeding them, there are signs of very obvious distress because they all congregate together at the spot where the food normally would be thrown, and they are threshing the water about, which is not their normal behavior. They come up to the surface and they thresh the water. So these signs of distress are a reminder to us. We have forgotten to feed them. So animals do exhibit these external signs when they are in distress. But when these koi have had their fill, they disappear to the depths of the pond and they swim about quite peacefully. They never come near the surface. So what Job is saying is, think of me and the expressions to which I give vent as an indication of the fact that I am in desperate need. Otherwise, I wouldn't be talking like this. So what he's saying, in other words, is, don't blame me, Eliphaz. I am justified. It is legitimate for me to complain because my suffering is unjustified. There are more and more elaborate metaphors to be found in verse 6. Can that which is unsavory be eaten without salt? Or is there any taste in the white of an egg? Whilst the individual metaphors can be explained, the thought in the verse needs some care in order to explain it. We tackle the metaphors first. Can that which is unsavory be eaten without salt? It's very straightforward. What it means is food that is bland or insipid needs salt, or if you prefer, MSG, to make it palatable. So far, so good. The second metaphor, is there any taste in the white of an egg, is rather tricky. We need to pay attention to two words, white, which in Hebrew is re'er, R-E-E-R phonetically, and egg, which is kalamus. The tricky part is this. If you look at the Brown Driver Briggs Hebrew lexicon, the word that is rendered white in the KJV literally means slimy juice, like the mucus that flows from the nose when you're having a cold. So what is this slimy juice and how do we connect it with the second part, which is the egg? Kalamus, again, according to the Brown Driver Briggs lexicon, although the KJV has rendered it as egg, it literally means purslane, P-U-R-S-L-A-N-E, which is a plant, a specific type of plant that produces a thick, slimy juice, which is tasteless. And although some people consider this plant a weed, this plant can actually be cultivated and eaten either raw or cooked. And health freaks apparently relish purslane because it is very rich in omega-3 fatty acids, in vitamins A, B and C. It is very rich in dietary minerals. And as a result, this juice, which is found in the leaves and in the stem, is very much treasured. So it can be used as a dietary supplement. But the point is that the juice of this plant is slimy, just like mucus. So how did the white of an egg come into this picture? I believe that this situation illustrates the difficulty faced by any translator in trying to render a metaphor in the original language into an equivalent metaphor in a totally different language. Hebrew and English are as far apart as night from day. So if you have a metaphor in Hebrew and you're trying to give an accurate rendition in English or vice versa, it's going to be extremely difficult. And I believe the KJV translators opted for the phrase white of an egg as being more comprehensible to the average English reader. But literally, it refers to the slimy juice of the purslane. so much for the meaning of the idioms and the metaphors. What is the underlying thought in verse 6? Verse 6 once again reads, "Can that which is unsavory be eaten without salt? Or is there any taste in the white of an egg?" The underlying thought is this: certain things are naturally associated with one another, so that the one serves as a complement to the other. If one is missing, the other is incomplete. Thus, food that is bland needs a proper condiment, either salt or MSG. And this idea of certain things being naturally associated is reinforced by the second metaphor in verse 6. So what Job is saying is this: he is using these metaphors in verse 6 to drive home the point to his friends that his outspoken lamentation and grief and complaints were commensurate with the degree of unjustified suffering that he is experiencing. In other words, just as salt goes with bland food, my complaints and my cries go with the kind of suffering I am experiencing. Verse 7, "The things that my soul refused to touch are as my sorrowful meat." Soul is not difficult to understand. It is used as representative of self. So what is the meaning of verse 7? "The things that my soul refused to touch are as have now become the food that even as I eat it brings sorrow to me." Since Job's present focus is on his illness, what he is saying, the thought underlying verse 7 is, I now have to live with what was previously detestable to me. And if you think of the boils on his body as the manifestations of some skin disease, perhaps it was leprosy, you can understand better the thought of this verse. If we take it for argument's sake as leprosy, that this is what he was stricken with, Job would have seen lepers in his time for sure. And everybody looking at a leper would naturally be tempted to keep as far away as possible because of the manifest sores and wounds on the body of the leper. So what Job is saying is, I would have kept away from people with this disease. And now, lo and behold, I'm stricken with the disease. I can't run away. I have to live with it. The things that my soul refused to touch are as my sorrowful meat. What follows next in the 6 verses 8 through 13 constitute Job's cry to be released from his afflictions through death. Having said that, I must emphasize you cannot use this section, verses 8 through 13, to justify either suicide or euthanasia. It is the unregenerate person who looks to death as a quick and easy solution when he is caught in some great material disaster or he is faced with the potential of severe and public embarrassment. Then the unregenerate person would be inclined to take his own life as a quick end to his ordeal. But what the unregenerate person doesn't realize is there is a life hereafter, there is an accounting to God which no man, believer or unbeliever, can run away from. Job, as a born-again believer, longs for death, not to get away from his troubles. He's not looking for a quick and easy solution via the avenue of death. If so, he would just commit suicide or someone to kill him, euthanasia. What Job is saying is, I want, given the kind of sufferings that I'm experiencing in earthly life, there's no value in continuing to live. I would rather go home to be with the Lord, and because I know I will then have an eternal life of bliss. So he is seeking that kind of release, not the kind of release of an unbeliever seeking a quick death. Where we read verses 8 to 13, there are certain words that need to be explained. Oh, that I might have my request, and that God would grant me the thing that I long for, even that it would please God to destroy me, that he would let loose his hand and cut me off. Verse 9 by itself is proof enough that no believer should ever consider suicide as a solution, as a way out. Because in his extreme distress, Job never talks of suicide. Even when he longs for death, verse 9 is his acknowledgement that only God can release him through death. He has no right to take his own life because he never gave that life. So he can't take it away. Only God can. Therefore, he's saying in verse 9 that it is God who, if he sees fit, can destroy me with a word and release me from my suffering. Verse 10. Then should I yet have comfort, yea, I would, and this is the difficult part, I would harden myself in sorrow. Typically, sorrow breaks a person. And what on earth does Job mean when he says, I would harden myself in sorrow? Let him, God, not spare. For I have not concealed the words of the Holy One. What is my strength that I should hope, and what is mine end that I should prolong my life? Is my strength the strength of stones, or is my flesh of brass? Is not my help in me, and is wisdom driven quite from me? So this is a, there are many words and phrases that are difficult and need some care in explaining. Let's look at that phrase that I highlighted earlier. I would harden myself in sorrow. The word rendered harden in Hebrew is salad, which interestingly enough is used only once in the Old Testament. This is the only place, Job chapter 6 verse 10, where that particular Hebrew word salad is used. Although the KJV translators have opted for the meaning harden, the Brown Driver Briggs lexicon says that the literal meaning is to leap for joy. So here is a difficulty. What has the literal meaning leaping for joy got to do with hardening oneself? Because this is the only place where the word is used, there's no other place where a similar word is used, so we can't compare to get an idea of the present meaning. But if you think of a stallion, a wild horse, pounding the ground with its hooves and then leaping up into the air, that imagery would convey the meaning of this verse. And this verse, if you take that meaning, that Job hardening himself in sorrow means he would leap for joy, is consonant with the meaning in the first part of the verse. I should yet have comfort, yea, I would harden myself. So if you accept that approach, then you would read it like this. I would have comfort if God were to release me from by death. I would be so comforted that I would leap for joy. So what he is saying then is, let him, let God not spare, let him unleash on me that which will quickly bring my life to a close. And the reason that Job gives that God should act fast and take away his life is a very interesting reason. Because I have not concealed the words of the Holy One. What Job is saying is, look, I can make this unusual request to God. Lord, take away my life. I can afford to make this strange request to God because all through my life, I have declared my faith, I have shown obedience to the one living and true God. And because of that, can I not be bold and approach God directly and say, hear this request, take away my life. If I have not lived a godly life, I wouldn't dream of being so bold as to approach God and ask for this favor. But now I can ask a favor. This is a favor that He's asking God, take away my life. Because he has lived a consistent and godly life. It's a very roundabout way of expressing a death wish. We now come to the last section of chapter 6, 14 through 30, but in this lesson we shall just look at verses 14 through 21. It has to be read in different stages. Verse 14 first, to him that is afflicted, pity should be showed from his friend. But he forsaketh the fear of the Almighty. 15 through 21. My brethren have dealt deceitfully as a brook, and as a stream of brooks they pass away, which are blackish by reason of the ice, and wherein the snow is hid. What time they wax warm, they vanish. When it is hot, they are consumed out of their place. And then verses 18 through 21. The paths of their way are turned aside, they go to nothing and perish. The troops of Tamar looked, the companies of Sheba waited for them. They were confounded because they had hope. They came thither and were ashamed. For now ye are nothing, ye see my casting down and are afraid. If you take it out of context, it's difficult to understand, but with the context of verse of chapter 6 as we have studied this far, we have enough background material to understand verses 14 through 21. Verse 14, he forsaketh the fear of the Almighty. This is basically Job's sharp rebuke to Eliphaz. And he delivers this rebuke by the use of an implied simile. The simile used by Job is this: he who fails to show compassion towards and empathy for a friend in distress has effectively failed to show reverence for the one living and true God. And in a way, this thought is echoed much later by James. In his epistle, chapter 2, verse 13, James writes, he shall have judgment without mercy that showed no mercy. This gels with what Job is saying in verse 14. He who fails to show compassion for and empathy for a friend in distress has basically failed to show reverence for the one living and true God. So that is a very sharp rebuke to Eliphaz. And then verses 15, 16, and 17. My brethren have dealt deceitfully as a brook, as the stream of brooks they pass away, which are blackish by reason of the ice, and wherein the snow is hid. What time they wax warm, they vanish. When it is hot, they are consumed out of their place. What on earth does this mean? Job here compares the loyalty of his three friends to the streams in the desert, which are very necessary in sustaining the life of travelers. What happens is, in the springtime, these channels in the desert are filled with the melting snow. But when you really need them, it is in summer, when you are traveling across the desert in summer, that's when you need them the most. When you go to the locations where these streams are known to be running, you find that the streams have dried up and therefore they fail to deliver the life-preserving water. And this metaphor is reinforced by verses 18 to 21, which relate to caravans crossing the scorching desert between Tamar in northwest Arabia and Sheba in southwest Arabia. So, as I said, verses 15 through 21 constitute a stinging rebuke of Eliphaz and his friends. And Job delivers this rebuke not directly as in prose, but via a series of very sophisticated metaphors. Metaphor is a very powerful medium for delivering a message. If you know how to use the right metaphor at the right place, at the right time. We will continue with the rest of chapter 6 next Sunday.